Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
I got a real big one.
Here's John Williams.
A rocket-sized one in just a minute. It's 109. This is John. Thanks for tuning us in. We're here until 3 o'clock on weekdays. 10 till noon on Saturdays on WGN Radio. You can always find me on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter at WGN King John. I want to be king. Someday. Hasn't happened yet. Paperwork's tied up in Cook County. Once we can get it out of Cook County, I really like my chances. And when I am, by golly, things are going to start to happen. I mean, assault weapons, boom, done. They come to me and they go, hey, King, listen, we really like to hunt. And it's the Second Amendment. I go, yeah, what do you want? They go, these assault kind of style weapons. I'll go, no. Next. The problem was just solved. Just like that. I don't need no student walkout. I'll just go, yeah, you're not going to get to have those anymore. Next. And I get to be king. But again, the paperwork is tied up in Cook County. And not everybody's going to love the kingdom. I know that. I know that. When I was the president of the Manuka Community High School senior class of 1977, my campaign speech for that office was longer lunch periods. Times have changed. Can you imagine the crap these kids are thinking about and having to deal with? I mean, good grief. The idea of school safety in 1977. Violetta, you graduated from high school after that. Was that an issue for you guys when you were walking up and down the halls?
Not at all. We were thinking about how we could ditch class and...
Me too.
And a
Actually,
lot simpler.
Things. I wasn't. The bad kids were.
Right, yeah. No, I wasn't either.
I was a good kid.
Yeah, me too.
But it wasn't like that. A friend of mine, Tracy, a former producer here, is very interested in the vaping mechanisms, the tools, you know, what do you call that, that you vape with?
Yeah, a vape pen.
A vape pen, how kids are sneaking those into junior high schools, and you can put marijuana in there and then silently vape pot at school. I guess the high schoolers will do that as well. And I'm thinking, man, that was not an issue at Manuka Community High School.
No one snuck to the back to have a cigarette.
Yeah, they did that. Now that you mention it, you bet they did. They were smoking in the boys' room.
In the locker room,
In the locker room on campus, in the back of the
bus.
In
the broken shower that never worked.
Is that where they
did it? I don't know,
it?
But I just heard. That's what happened.
So now the kids board buses and they go from, you know, Parkland High School or wherever these particular students live to the state capitol. And as they are in transit, they find out that some of the things that they were most interested in will not even come up. House Representative Keon McGee of Miami invoked the Parkland shooting in requesting that House Bill 219 there, which would ban AR-15 rifles and other guns defined as assault weapons and large capacity magazines, be moved from committee right to the House floor for questions, debate, and a vote. Now, that's an extraordinary thing. That's not the way it normally happens, and it's the way it didn't happen. And I don't know if it should happen that way or not. You know, you should not, in the heat of the moment, throw something out there when everybody's emotionally charged and say, okay, let's vote this way. And so they didn't. Maybe calmer heads will prevail and they'll see the wisdom of my thinking. But 36-71, they voted not to take that up. So it sounds like then that where the Florida legislature could have voted to ban AR-15s, they didn't. But they did pass a measure which deemed pornography dangerous in schools. I guess that's the sort of thing that legislatures sometimes do, but the two of those coming at about the same time sure looked bad for the folks in Florida. The students, though, just to the kid, impressed me with their sort of, I don't know.
Their diligence, their ability to come together and speak eloquently about the issue.
That's really what I'm thinking about. It's just how, you know, and look, when you're that age, I was strident about school lunches at Manuka High School. Imagine yourself being thrust into the national spotlight. So you do get a little preachy. You do get a little didactic. You do get a little strident when you're that age, and particularly when you're talking about something like this. But I'm going to let them have it. Let them have all the floor and stage and time and space they want. Let them talk. And yet there is trending now. And some of them are so good. Some of them are so good at this that there's this trend afoot on some social media sites and on Twitter and on YouTube that maybe some of those quote-unquote students are paid actors. They're people that they rush in there and they say, okay, I'm a student, interview me, and the next thing you know, they've got a voice.
But all of the other people standing with them are students and
wait,
are coming
fake,
forward.
Right, John?
And even that is fake.
That's the problem. When you talk about fake news, there it is. Right?
Well, absolutely, Steve. Absolutely. I mean, and lending the credence to that is that one of these young men who has been on TV a lot, you'd recognize him if you saw him, his father is an ex-FBI agent. And so, say the conspiracy theorists, well, this is what it is. The FBI is embarrassed by this. They're putting this kid, or this guy is embarrassed by it. They're propping this kid up to do the dad's bidding. The FBI is in a bad place, blah, blah, blah. So this kid's out there calling on the legislatures to do things.
So are you saying the news stations know that he's a plant or that they are unintentionally covering the story wrong?
I am only saying that conspiracy theorists are putting that out
there. But this is exactly what's going on. So Violetta just heard you say that.
David Hogg.
She thinks now that maybe the guy's a plant. You know what I'm saying? This is how things...
There's a YouTube video you can watch right now called David Hogg the Actor. And it's of a local television report from Southern California in which a young surfer gets into an argument with another person about how real that is or not. Okay, what a tangent, right? What a just a ridiculous argument to have. But now people are talking about that. There was one state lawmaker in Florida whose legislative aide was putting forth stuff like that. It's cuckoo. And so the kids are walking off campus all across Florida. And what is it, Steve? Oak Park, River Forest? The kids walked off over there?
That's what I heard, yes.
Yeah, I don't know if your kids are, if your kids have walked off. And this is a question that comes up a lot, too. If your kids say, Mom, Dad, all of us kids are going to skip school today and we're going to protest. And then you say, well, what is it? And it could be guns or it could be LGBTQ rights, or it could be longer lunches. You know, do you support them in that? Do you say, well, that's not how I feel, or I'm not sure that's the best way to go about it? But what do you make of it when your kids say, that's it, we're out of here, we're going to bolt, we're going to walk right off the campus?
My parents would have said, get your butt in the chair, you're going to learn something about math and science, and they're going to teach you something today.
That's what mine would have said too. And I think that's because my issue was longer lunches at school. But if it was gun safety, I think my parents might be there with me on this one. Let's pick up a couple of phone lines. Danny, jump in there. What did you want to say? You're on the air.
Yes. When we're all these kids going to, you know, all the capitals and this and that, and leaving school on the bus, if, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't Hitler try to seduce the youth and use the youth?
There was a Nazi youth movement, but I don't know what that has to do with what we're talking about.
What does it have to do? Let these kids be kids, all right? You put them in the spotlight, you stick microphones in their face, you ask, let them be kids, let them grow up.
And the difference, though, is, thanks for the call, Hitler put the kids up to it. I don't know who's putting these kids up to it except these kids themselves.
The kids are trying to push the adults to do something.
It is so upside down, isn't it? That's really what is unique about this. You know, the difference maybe between this and some of the other school shootings, I mean, Newtown, of course, comes to mind, is that those kids were too young to speak for themselves, for their fallen colleagues, for their parents, for their school administrators. That was a grade school. But if it's at a high school, of course, Columbine was a high school too. And I don't remember the spotlight shining on the high school kids speaking out afterwards in Columbine than the way we see it today. I don't know why that's different. Maybe we're reaching some sort of tipping point. Hey, Chuck, you're on the air. What did you want to say? Hi.
Hey, how you doing? I'd like to say that some of your advertisers that advertise on your station there, they sell the bullets for those weapons. And I think as long as you're trying to make a stance on this and have that, I'm from up in Wisconsin. Weapon of choice in Wisconsin in the combines and the feed trucks and grain wagons. You guys' broadcast goes all the way up to the other side of Madison. You can listen to you on the radio, and their weapon of choice is the AR-15. So I think you need to get a little bit better grip on your audience. I know a lot of people in the city are all worked up over this, but, you know, you got to understand a few things. you know, some people do need that weapon to shoot coyotes and varmints. And recently we just spotted a cougar right there in Brookfield, Wisconsin. How would you like to have that? What are you going to get that with, a BB gun? I don't think so.
Thanks for the call, Chuck. I'm going from you to Bob. You're on WGN. Bob, what did you want to say? Hi.
John.
Hey.
That last caller, I'm sorry. I can't even comment on him.
But just give me what you got, Bob.
To Violetta's point, you remember 66, 67, 68, 69? It was the kids who got up on the street and said, enough is enough.
Yeah, that's
We're
true.
We're not putting up with this crap anymore. And hopefully these children who are looking at it now will look back and go, hey, we can make a difference.
Now, that's an interesting point. I appreciate the phone call. Thanks for getting in here. It's 119. We'll take more phone calls on this today, tomorrow, the next day, the next day. Daniel Ellsberg will join us in the, what time is he coming on, 1:30 or 2? He's coming on at 2:05. Daniel Ellsberg has a book out called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. It's about everything from the Dr. Strangelove years to today. It's absolutely fascinating. And this is just the curious aside. I'll tell you now, and then we don't have to dwell on it when he comes on. But he was just talking about how he worked for the RAND Corporation, this research and diagnostic corporation that advised the government and military. They would do studies like, okay, if the Russians have nuclear weapons, the Soviets, and we have nuclear weapons, what happens? If they launch theirs first, what should our response be, et cetera, et cetera. And they did all sorts of research projects for the government. And towards the end of the book, you know, after World War II, after Vietnam, development of the H-bomb has come along now. We're in this Cold War stalemate with the Soviets. Anyway, he said that one of the documents that came to him was this. The Soviets launched nuclear weapons, nuclear rockets are incoming. We've got about 15 minutes. What are we going to do? If our early warning detection system picks up a whole bunch of incoming blips, this is what we do. By this time, we have taken 1,000 Atlas rockets. First stage, you know, the great big rocket that launches a rocket up to the moon. We get about 1,000 of those. And we mount them horizontally on stands on Earth. And we point them all towards Hawaii. When the rockets are coming over the pole into the United States, we hit the button and all 1,000 rockets start thrusting. And they push the Earth in the opposite direction of its rotation. And just for an instant, we stop the rotation of the Earth. Meanwhile, the rockets are coming in at their designated points from the Soviets, but now they're going to overfly their targets because we briefly halted the rotation of the planet. They go, whoa! If rockets could go, that's what they would say. Whoa! Hey, wait! Said the rockets. And when he looked at that, he thought, well, this is a joke, right? It was not. And it had gone through several military planners and people at the Pentagon, etc. He says in the book, it was at that point that I thought, maybe I'm in the wrong line of business. But you, and then he said, you know, here's the problem with that. If you briefly halt the rotation of the Earth, okay, just, you know, humor them. This is a research project so that the incoming rockets will miss their targets. They're still going to hit something. That's bad. But B, everything on Earth that isn't tied down will go flying, right? Imagine if you were running with a tub of water and you hit the brakes, the water would still go. It would splash over the edge. That's what would happen to our oceans. The oceans would go out and then come roaring back. We would have a global tsunami. Literally, a ball in the air would go, phew, anything not tied down. The whole Earth would be wiped out if we could for a second stop its rotation, he said. Justin Kaufman just strolled into the studio. You'll hear him. You on tonight, Justin?
I'm not. There's Blackhawks game. Nope. But I'm doing a happy hour live show in front of a live audience at WeWork Kinsey, 20 West Kinsey tonight.
Yeah, how about that?
It's fun.
You've done this sort of thing before.
Yeah, we do. I've done shows live on stage. This one is more of a happy hour feel, which means you can bring in the free food and the free drink.
I haven't been to this version. You said free food.
Yeah, free food and
free beverage.
Drink. Yep.
Is that just for the staff or is it for anybody?
No, it's for
comes?
I mean, it's what I can't finish.
Do you take a sip of each of them? Or
I do. It's really just if you stick around my table, and I sometimes will have leftovers. You can grab it.
I feel so hoodwinked. I was really enthusiastic about
this. Free.
Are our listeners invited?
Yes, they are. It's a 20 West Kinzie. You can find all that information at WGNRadio.com. It's a RSVP, but it's right after work, 5 to 6-ish. Cook County Commissioner Bridget Gaynor, Jamal Cole from My Hood, My Block, My City, Yuri Lane, who's a beatboxer and educator in town, so we're going to have some fun.
That My Hood, My Block, My City guy is pretty good.
He's great. He's been doing some great work. He was one of the guys who organized a team of volunteers to shovel out sidewalks when the Snowmageddon came through 2 weeks ago.
So you're going to have these people up and do kind of a live show.
Yeah, it's a live download, really.
Is it some comedy shtick,
too? Yeah, I'm working on it.
Okay, here's a joke. Use this joke, because I know jokes. I used to edit a joke book. Okay, so here's a joke.
And that's not a joke.
Hey, did you hear about the tanker with red paint? It collided with a tanker of purple paint. Both crews are believed to be marooned. Right?
Violetta loves it. Yeah. She loves
I'm still trying to figure
it out. So that is like a joke.
Well, it's a big thing in the business community. Color palette jokes are huge.
See, that's I'm thinking forward here.
Yeah, you are. It's a very 2.0 progressive.
Modern.
Let me try it again.
Right.
Hey, Justin.
Yeah.
Did you hear about the tanker with red paint? It collided with a tanker of purple paint. Now both crews are believed to be marooned.
I think that gap was too small. The first gap was too big. So somewhere in the middle.
I liked it. You try it.
See, here you tell it.
Okay, what's in the news today? Well, let me start here. Did you guys see the news out on the East Coast?
Is that your Johnny Carson?
This is my Jay Leno. there was a tanker that collided. It had red paint.
Yeah,
red paint. Okay. I had collided with a tanker with purple paint.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, hey.
I guess now they're both marooned.
You know what? That was better. That's where
the jazz guy comes in with a little drum thing, and they play a little bit.
But you know, let's at least agree that that's A material, right?
It is A material.
It really, you can't screw that one up.
You're going to watch me do that tonight. I'm going to be there, and everybody's going to go, man, Kaufman's color palette jokes are spot on, and I won't give credit to John. And then
you should do them two or three times, though, because people love repeat jokes like that.
Neutron comes up to an electron and says, hey, why so negative?
Okay. For the science show, when we do a science show.
That would be like two jokes in a row.
When we go out to Argonne National
Go to WGNRadio.com.
Yep, /events.
/events.
It'll be up on the front page. You can
Find out how to go to the event at 5 o'clock.
5 o'clock, happy hour, free drinks.
Yeah, okay.
I love that that's where I go. That's my first thing I go, hey, it's free drinks. Otherwise, why would you want to come?
The memo in house was like, free drinks, free food, free drinks, free food, free drinks, free food. Justin Kaufman will be.
Yeah.
Listen, I got to get into the newsroom, but just give me 48 seconds on the conversation you had last night.
Artie Lang was on last night. Check it out at WGNRadio.com. He was talked about the episode of Crashing. He stars on HBO's Crashing, and the episode on Sunday was called Artie, and it was all about his addiction to heroin.
I don't watch that show, but you evidently have a nice relationship with him because you dove right into that.
Yeah, I mean, he knew what he was coming out because we asked him to come on to talk about it because the episode is really, really good. It's really good because it's
addiction to heroin. And it's funny because it's rare that you have somebody who still seems to be in the throes of it, like I'm on, I'm off, and then speak candidly about it. Like, it may happen yet again. He had a very sort of matter-of-fact attitude about it. It was sad. It was enlightening.
And imagine having to, I mean, it's a written show. It's not improv or anything like that. So Artie Lang had to perform as Artie Lang on the show Crashing to talk about his troubles with heroin. It was really moving. And Artie last night explained what he went through to do that and then talked a little bit about his continuing battle with addiction.
It was absolutely eye-opening and candid. That's also at WGNRadio.com. Check on the download with Justin Kaufman.
Thanks, John.
Phil Vitale joins us on Wednesdays to talk about the restaurant scene in Chicago. Nice to see you again, Phil. How are you?
Thank you, John. I'm great.
You are? Are you? You're like one of the judges of the James Beard Awards.
I'm one of the committees. Yeah, the Chef and Restaurants Awards Committee.
So, what are the James Beard Awards?
They are, depending on how nicely you think of them. They are the Oscars of the food business.
How are you able to sample all of the restaurants in the country to come up with the the nominees and the award winners?
Well, we can't sample all of them, but we do sample a lot of them. For one thing, the committee I'm on has people from representatives from around the country, divided into 10 different regions, and we have working with us a number of anonymous judges that we also rely on to get into some areas. In my particular regions, say, I have judges in Indianapolis, I have judges in Cleveland and Cincinnati, and I try to get to those cities as well, and I was in Detroit not too long ago. But, you know, I rely on the people on the ground who are actually in there eating, you know, frequently to give me
info. Are these people all restaurant critics per se?
Mostly, yes. I do have some people who are food writers or cookbook authors or in the business in some way, but they're not chefs. They can't be chefs.
So I get that point. But so then, as you all do your business, reviewing and writing about food all the time, essentially, you're always going out as a James Beard judge then, too. If you stumbled upon something, you'd go, wow, we should consider this.
Sure. That would go into the back of my mind. Right. My first and foremost responsibility is to the good people of Chicago and anybody in the sound of my voice and read my reviews, of course. But yeah, when I go into another place, if I really like the place, you start thinking, wow, this place deserves national attention.
And can a small restaurant or a restaurant in a smaller town compete?
Sure. One of the things we do with this semifinalist list that just came out is we try very hard to get into other areas and to shine the light into other corners. Will a small restaurant like that get a great deal of voter support in its first year? Maybe not.
Oh, that's right. Because say you found a place you liked in a small town. Don't you need more than one judge, or can one judge him or herself propel that to the James Beard Awards?
If the case is strong enough, I think yes.
Oh, so they'll sit down with a bunch of committee members and go, okay, I really love this place. Trust me, guys, it's awesome.
Right. We communicate back and forth, and some judges advocate extremely well for the restaurants they feel strongly about, and they're qualified. They're people I know that are.
But 250 judges don't speak with one voice. Have you ever gone to a place that you thought, you know what, actually, I don't think this is as good as the awards make them sound?
As much as I can within the non-disclosure agreement, I can tell you that there are disagreements even in the meeting that this ballot is formed with.
Yeah.
There's back and forthing.
So here's the nominees for best new restaurant, chef, bar scene, etc., bakery, bakers. How did Chicago do? There's rising star chefs. There's a bunch of categories. I'm looking at hundreds of names and restaurants here. How did Chicago do overall?
We did very well. Typically, we do very well, particularly in categories such as best new restaurant and outstanding chef and outstanding restaurant. Chicago has won the Outstanding Restaurant Award 2 years running at the James Beard Gala.
Who are the last two winners?
Alinea, and Topola Bampo.
So nominated this year for Best New Restaurant are Hai Su in Chicago.
For Best New, right.
And
Mitakaya.
Mitakaya. Those are the two that, and then Vivica in, or no, Vicia in St. Louis. I'm looking for anything else that would be within a reasonable drive. Lady of the House in Detroit.
Yeah, my Detroit people love that place. It's really getting a lot. And I've been to Le Sablon in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and that's a very nice and refined French restaurant.
Is it the whole experience? Is it just the food? Is it how does somebody get nominated for any of these things? You know what I mean?
Right. The food drives almost everything. I mean, we're not immune to the appeal of lovely surroundings and beautiful table appointments and all that and fancy tablecloths. But I can tell you that Mitakaya has none of those things, really. It's got fewer than two dozen seats, and it is not ornate. It is a tiny little thing, but the chef Diana Davila is very talented.
Food is good. Best baker, Greg Wade at Publican Quality Bread is nominated.
He made the final five last year, so he is. I mean, he's well known within the industry and not just in Chicago.
Outstanding bar program, one Chicago restaurant,
right?
Lost Lake,
right?
What's that?
It's kind of a tiki themed bar. It's very nice.
See, a tiki-themed bar.
Yeah, we've got a few of those.
From Chicago?
Yeah.
Don't we have somebody serving quality Manhattans at a steakhouse that could get nominated here?
Well, keep in mind that Violet Hour and the Aviary have already won in this category. So we're running, you know, so we've got Violet Hour, a restaurant I would probably be happy to re-nominate. Well, they won already, so we're looking elsewhere.
Outstanding chef in Chicago, Spiaggia and Naha. Tony Mantuano and Carrie Nabedian are nominated.
They've been on the ballot before.
Yeah, I know those names.
They've done well, so you know, fingers crossed. Chicago gets some votes in the there are two rounds of voting. First, all the different voters will vote on this ballot you see in front of you, and all these names, and then the top five names in each category will be the finalists, and then there will be a second round of voting to determine the winners that will be announced May 7th in Chicago.
Just want to mention two other restaurants real quick before I ask you about one specifically. Outstanding restaurant. So this is the overall, like, outstanding restaurant. Would that be the restaurant of the year?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so one Chicago restaurant is here. Mm-hmm. That's North Pond in Chicago.
Right.
L'Etoile in Madison. I know that's not Chicago, but it's not that far away. And Little Old Madison has a restaurant nominated.
Yeah, Mad City. Look at that.
What's North Pond like?
North Pond is actually adjacent to the actual North Pond in Lincoln Park.
We talked about that just a week ago or
right.
so.
Right. It's this beautiful. The building itself was originally a warming house that the park district had for people who ice skated on North Pond. You could go back in there and warm up and maybe get a hot chocolate or something. And then they leased the property to a restaurant more than 10 years ago. And they actually expanded it a little bit. But the interior of that space is so pretty. It's all done in this arts and crafts style.
Yeah.
The post-war style that was so popular. And it's just a beautiful example of it. And it's a terrific restaurant. And Bruce has won for Best Chef Great Lakes in the past.
By the way, props real quick for outstanding service, Boca and Sepia. You've talked about both of those on this show before. Boarding House for the outstanding wine program.
That's Alpinist Place.
Charles Jolly.
Jolly.
Craft House Cocktails for outstanding wine, beer, or spirits. So I got to go check out Craft House Cocktails. That's a place?
No, it's a product. You will find that in upscale retail stores. He has mastered the art of cocktails in a jar, just open and pour on ice.
I have seen those. I've never bought those.
They're very, very good.
Craft House Cocktails.
Also available in first class on United Airlines if you ever get up that part of the plane. I don't. Sometimes I walk through it depending on where they board me.
That's the saddest thing. Never look left because it'll just break your heart when you get on the plane.
And
don't
they
even go
them
there.
First. So I know. You have this walk of shame. It's like, okay, you're better than me. You're better than me. You're better than me. You're better than me.
And you know, sometimes it's a right turn. Sometimes it's a left turn. Depends on how big the plane is. But if you do walk by them, you make the right turn and you go through first class to get to where the rest of us schlubs are.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're already having their champagne.
Yes.
And I think, could they just not wait?
Yeah.
Could you just wait until we close the doors and then give them their champagne? We already know that we're not them.
Yeah. Go ahead. Rub
it
in
some
more. Do
you have to flaunt it? $65 oyster tart is not the only reason to check out Bellamore, says Phil Vittel. What's this restaurant?
This is a new restaurant in a space that used to belong to a restaurant called Embea. It's on the corner of Jefferson and Randolph. It's the chef is Jimmy Papadopoulos, and as I mentioned, if you've been eating around the Chicago suburbs and city in the last 7 or so years, you've had his food, but you might have had it at Sam and Harry's, a steakhouse in Schaumburg, and then Jimmy was the opening chef at Bohemian House on Illinois Street in River North, where he was doing Czechoslovakian and Czech-inspired food. And now here at Bellamore, he's doing the food he's always wanted to do. And so he's doing it. So it's, you'd have to call it contemporary American, the umbrella description that means nothing.
Yeah, I know.
it's there for what it's not. Okay, you hear contemporary American, you say, okay, it's not really a steakhouse, it's not really Italian, it's not really French, it's not, it's It's local food. It's seasonal food. It's chef-driven, which means it's the stuff the chef likes and his idea of what good food should taste like.
Yeah, but $65 oyster tarts, isn't that a little pricey, Phil?
It's a little pricey, and he actually was a little nervous putting it on the menu originally. But two fun facts. One, when the Boca Group people first auditioned him saying, hey, maybe we should do something someday, he made this oyster pie, and they took two bites, and he said, we got to get this guy.
You're hired.
So this is, in a way, this is the dish that got him this guy. It got him this gig that got him into this particular restaurant. It is this wonderful oyster custard on a flaky base, and on top of that is a beautifully trimmed, pristine oyster and a big old lump, dump, pile of caviar, fancy et cetera caviar, and little bits of diced apple. And there are two slices, so it's an easy, you share it with another person. So you have two little wedges of that pie, and then it's served with a glass of vintage champagne. So when you put all that together, $65 is not like outrageous. It looks bad on the bottom line, but for the quality of what you're getting, you're not getting a big spoonful of caviar for less than $30 anywhere. And the same thing with the flute of champagne of vintage champagne.
Bellamore, says Phil Vitale. He liked the cocktails. He liked the service there, mm-hmm. too.
Very pretty space, too. It's gorgeous.
Reviews at chicagotribune.com/dining. All right, Phil. Nice to see you again. Thanks for doing the work you do, man. Let's talk next Wednesday.
I can't, but I can go the week after that.
Okay. Well, you and Elle have worked that out. Keep doing what you do, Phil Vitale.
Thank you.
Read him in the chicagotribune.com/dining.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Or
here's John Williams.
We get someone else to do it. Mm-hmm. Either way, we try our best to bring you some of those. It's 2:07. This is John here weekdays from 1 to 3.
Lord have mercy.
Saturdays, check me out from 10 a.m. until 12 noon. We might get preempted a little bit in the near future with White Sox baseball and Northwestern basketball. The Big Ten tournament's coming. We'll keep you posted on those things. And yeah, White Sox baseball, the first preseason game on WGN Radio in a very long time, is going to be Friday. I think it'll take the last hour of this show to get going. I think it's a 2 o'clock first pitch. Hard to believe we're saying that.
2:05.
Baseball right around the corner and here on WGN Radio. Daniel Ellsberg is the guy who you know as the guy from the Pentagon Papers, also a longtime high-ranking advisor to presidents and to the Department of Defense. His doomsday machine, Confessions of a Nuclear Planner, is positively fascinating. And he joins us now on WGN Radio. Daniel, this is John. You're on in Chicago. How are you?
Fine. Thank you for having me.
When's the last time you were in our Windy City, sir?
Wasn't so long ago. I was there speaking for the Doomsday Machine a couple of months ago on my book tour.
So,
with Rick Perlstein.
I see.
I think it was at the Writers. It was at a Writers Museum.
Oh, no kidding. Well, we do have some book conventions or events. Maybe you were here for one of our Printers Row things. I'm sorry I missed you in studio, but I'll take you on the phone here. Congratulations on the book. I think a lot of us know you by name, but we don't know that much about your work in this detail. And now here it is. Was this something you had in mind your whole life? Someday I'm going to talk in more detail about this work I did?
Pretty much. As you know, I really copied material from my top secret safe on nuclear war planning and command and control, the possibility of accidents and false alarms, back into Rand Corporation. At the same time, I was copying documents on the Pentagon Papers, and it was my on Vietnam decision-making. It had been my intention to put the nuclear material out after I was tried or after the Pentagon Papers material had whatever effect it could have on shortening the Vietnam War. And that didn't come about because the documents were lost where they'd been stored by my brother. They were lost in a hurricane that disturbed the hiding place.
You're kidding. Which documents are you speaking about there?
It's a peculiar story, I understand. But that's a brief account of it.
Okay, but that delayed then? But that information you're speaking about, was that what you used for the Doomsday Machine?
Yes, the substance of what was in those documents, which were old memos of mine, notes of mine, estimates, and some studies that had been done by various people. The substance of that is in my new book, which I had hoped to get published much long ago, since the war ended. But they've never, publishers in general, up until Bloomsbury, were dubious that people would want to read about nuclear war. Anything with the title of nuclear in it was thought to be poison for publishers. And so I couldn't get it published, but I did. I spent 40 years then really trying to work with an anti-nuclear movement that would be similar to the anti-war movement, and with some success at the Nuclear Freeze campaign back in the early 80s. But since then, people have the mistaken idea that the problem has gone away with the Cold War. It should have gone away, but the weapons stayed. Even though there are fewer of them, there's more than enough weapons to cause what Herman Kahn called a doomsday machine. That is the death of nearly everyone on Earth.
When I think of the doomsday machine, and I like that you reference it throughout the book, the movie...
Dr. Strangelove.
Dr. Yeah. Strangelove. I mean, it's one of my favorite films.
Kubrick used. Well, it's worth seeing again and again. It hasn't really ever changed. And when I saw it in 1964, when it came out, when I was working in the Pentagon, we saw it during the working day as part of our work, we thought, and that was true. My boss and I came out of that theater saying that was a documentary. Everything in that, in the very esoteric details that seemed most crazy, and were crazy, were real, realistic, and remain so today to a very large extent.
Well, that movie was about, and the Doomsday Machine, and that is this notion that we have this sort of mutually assured destruction. We'll get a bunch of weapons, they'll get a bunch of weapons. Annihilation for the whole world will happen if either of us use them. So we sort of have this sort of agreement that we'll never use the weapons. That was mad, right?
There's never been an agreement we would never use those weapons. You know, both sides, especially starting in the mid-60s, on the Russian side, they were after us, have really spent day after day, 7 days a week, pretty much all year, preparing for an all-out nuclear war. And we're buying the weapons for them, which is crazy, but it's profitable. It's a little like Star Wars. It won't work, but it keeps people at work in smaller numbers than if the money were used otherwise. But it's votes, it's profits above all, it's campaign donations, and that's why we continue to have intercontinental ballistic missiles that have really been an anachronism for at least 50 years from about the time Dr. Strangelove came out. And yet we have a president, Donald Trump, who is continuing the plans of his predecessor, Barack Obama, to rebuild new versions of those ICBMs, which shouldn't exist at all. They should be dismantled, defunded, the money used otherwise, and yet Boeing and Lockheed are bidding for the new version of the ICBMs, which are really nothing other than triggers to doomsday.
Why do you say we don't need those weapons anymore?
Well, since the, in particular, even from a strategic Pentagon point of view, and I was a Pentagon planner, in effect, writing for Secretary of Defense McNamara in 61, even from the narrowest strategic military point of view, those weapons have been obsolete since the mid-60s, at least, if not earlier, when the Russians acquired a lot of sub-launched ballistic missiles, such as we'd had years earlier. But when they acquired them also, those are weapons that can't be targeted by our intercontinental ballistic missiles, or really anything else. We do have anti-submarine submarines, again, very profitable in places like Groton, Connecticut, and jobs, and so forth. Even when the Soviet Union ceased to exist, we continue to build subs like that. But they've never been likely to get the majority of Russian sub-launched missiles. And those are enough to destroy the United States as a society and most of the people in it. And in fact, cause nuclear winter inadvertently, which we can come back to, killing nearly everybody. Well, since that's true, our ICBMs have very little targets except the Russian ICBMs, destroying which would not prevent us from being annihilated ourselves. At the same time, they're targets for Soviet ICBMs. They're vulnerable. They can be targeted. Destroying them, our own, would deprive the Soviet, or Russian now, ICBMs of their targets, essentially. And they should get rid of theirs, too. But their position of these lightning rods for attack, basically, doesn't justify or require or even make any sense out of our having them.
Wait a minute. You're saying our missiles are targeted at their missile sites, and their missile sites are targeted at our missile sites, and since we have enough...
Essentially so, right.
Okay, so
and
if we got rid of ours...
We've gotten rid of them. They've talked about... Pardon me.
Well, my just to follow your train of thought, though, if I understand it, if we get rid of ours, then they won't have any need for theirs because they won't need them to blow up our missiles anymore.
They don't really have a need anyway, but they do have targets, namely mostly our own intercontinental ballistic missiles, which are static, land-based, and can be targeted and destroyed. Yes, they could. Would still have our cities as targets, which are targeted by their sub-launch missiles. There's a madness to all of this, essentially. But the tens, hundreds of billions of dollars spent on the ICBMs only make the world less safe, including ourselves. They tempt both sides to launch on warning, and that electronic warning, radar warning, and that has been false on both sides a number of times. We've come much closer to a preemptive attack on both the U.S. side and the Soviet side, now the Russian side, than almost anybody in the country realizes, even though it's on the record now. It's the kind of record that people don't buy and read. We've come close to a war that would have destroyed nearly all life, and in particular because each side has missiles it feels it has to get off the ground on warning before enemy warheads arrive. And so even if the warning is equivocal or ambiguous, and there have been times when they falsely believed it wasn't ambiguous, it was on the way, it was wrong. Fortunately, that was discovered just in time before we got our missiles off. Hmm. That's not a way for the human species to live. It's sort of living at the risk of what the Hawaiians people realized just a month ago or so, a couple months ago, when they got a false alert. And they lived with the awareness that we don't usually live with of the reality that's been true for over half a century, and that is that a mistake half a world away can lead to the end of most life on Earth.
Well, how much do you know about how it happens now? Because a lot of people are worried about Donald Trump having his finger on the button. Is it your understanding that the president could exclusively be the person that launches that? How much security do we have?
First of all, that's when it comes to launching, there is no exclusive finger, the president's or anybody else, not the Joint Chiefs or anyone. If that were true, then the other side, another side, or even a terrorist, could paralyze our ability to retaliate, our ability, just by hitting Washington, or even, if it really were just the president, by a bullet, or a few bullets. But the fact is that hitting Washington or Strategic Air Command headquarters, now Strategic Command in Offutt, in Omaha or elsewhere, would not paralyze our forces, and the same is true of Russia. They have developed a system, and they've trumpeted it just recently, refurbishing it after Trump became president. They had an article saying, yes, they were modernizing their dead hand system, which is their response to our threats of decapitating them. I'm pretty sure, by the way, that Kim Jong-un has a very similar system in North Korea. He reads about our rehearsals, really, and plans and preparations to assassinate him or decapitate their high command, it's been much in the paper, or invade North Korea. And he's almost certainly made the same kind of preparations we in Russia have, which is to assure that there will be other fingers that will be pressing buttons, even if his have been destroyed.
Okay, that's fine. I mean, but that assures then that you have the ability to use
the weapon. That's the way it is.
Well, but that assures the ability to use the weapon if you have them and you want to use them. I think some of the gist of my question was, how do we keep somebody from using them here when we don't want them to use it? A reactionary president, an irrational decision.
All of our presidents have done what Trump has announced, kept the nuclear option on the table, and that's the option of initiating nuclear war. None of our presidents have been willing to say, no first use, we won't initiate nuclear war. And we've prepared for that in every way. So that's really not new with Trump. Yes, people look at Trump and they say, this is a guy we're worried about. He may carry out those threats more likely than others. I don't think that all of the other threats, most of which were secret to us, not to the people who are being threatened, most of them were secret, and some of them may have been total bluffs. In fact, I feel sure they were. others not. And the chance that other presidents could have initiated this over Vietnam or other places in the Middle East, I think were real. And that, yes, they could be. Trump is scarier than others in the way he talks, in the way he acts. But the problem didn't start with Trump, and it won't really end with Trump. We've got to revise our entire nuclear policies here, which have kept the world, as have Russia's, as well. But neither one justifies the other in terms of keeping the whole world hostage to a escalation and a possible doomsday scenario, which would put smoke in the sky, in the stratosphere, where it wouldn't rain out smoke from burning cities that would block most 70% perhaps of sunlight and kill all the harvests and starve nearly everyone to death. This capability should not exist.
Yeah.
And it's a capability we have built decade by decade over the decades, and it should end. We should end it.
You point out in the book that, right, winning the nuclear war is kind of an oxymoron because everybody's going to die if you have a nuclear winter that goes 30 years where you literally cannot grow and sustain foodstuffs to feed your people, let alone the rest of the world's population. It's 2:21 on WGN. Daniel Ellsberg's on the phone. The Doomsday Machine is sort of this fascinating chronicle of his life where he was one of these war planners with some regret at times. But what's also fascinating to a lot of us these days is his role in the Pentagon. On papers and the little light that was shined on your role in that movie, The Post, most recently. Now, just talk to me about that in a minute on WGN. Just a couple minutes left with Daniel Ellsberg. His latest is The Doomsday Machine. His character had a cameo, not a cameo, but a small part in the movie The Post. Daniel, when you saw the movie, what did you think about the portrayal of your role in all of that?
Well, the portrayal is very, very nice because it's by a terrific actor, Matthew Rhys, of the series The Americans, who looks very much the way I did at the time, only better. So that's nice to see on the screen. And of course, that had to do with the exposing the Pentagon Papers, which when I gave them to the Chicago, they did come out in Chicago, actually, but first to the Times and then to the Washington Post and then to 17 other newspapers. They did play their role, ultimately, in helping shorten the war.
It was funny to see how arduous the copying process was back then.
Yes, well, page by page, and very... I didn't have time to put the cover down. At that time, that brilliant green light shining into my eyes, I wondered whether it was going to turn me blind eventually or not, but it didn't.
Did you wonder if you were committing treason or if you were going to go to jail for what you were doing?
No, I knew better than the American Constitution doesn't allow anyone to be charged with treason, and I wasn't, for giving truth to the American people. It's much narrower than that. You have to be waging war against the United States or adhering to its enemies, and I certainly didn't do that. So my patriotic motives were evaluated for the president by the CIA, as a matter of fact, and I wasn't charged with treason, but I was charged with 12 felony counts, and that was not a surprise to me, even though no one had ever been prosecuted before for doing this, and there was a reason for that. It essentially violates our Constitution, but they used the Espionage Act as if it were a British Official Secrets Act to criminalize. Well, I expected that, and I was facing 115 years in prison, but by a almost miraculous working of our democratic process, including whistleblowing by other people and telling truths by, say, John Dean, revealing the tapes by Alex Butterfield, refusing the attorney general, refusing to fire a special prosecutor. That we could face that almost any day now. All those things worked together and actually led to the dropping of my charges because the acts that the president had taken, Nixon, to shut me up about his plans were criminal in those days. Now, a lot of them are no longer criminal after 9/11. Even, it seems, attempting to incapacitate me at one point. We do have a kill list at this point under President Obama and probably still. But when it comes to burglarizing my former psychoanalyst's office, for instance, to get information to blackmail me into silence. That's pretty legal now, since 9/11. So our democracy has diminished, but there's enough of it left to challenge us, I think, to take care of these risks that we've been talking about on this program. It's hardly a factor in American consciousness now. I would say we're in a state of denial. And on this point, unlike climate, both parties are in denial about the real dangers. But I hope my book will bring undoubtedly bad news to a lot of people, but also a challenge to use our democracy to rid ourselves of this hostage situation.
Yeah, that's the book we're talking about, The Doomsday Machine. To be honest with you, when I was watching the movie and as I was reading the book, I was hopeful that the president would maybe take time to see both, watch the post.
Well, if we can get clips of it on Fox and Friends, I would be hopeful of that. Maybe there's a way to do that. It would be good.
Daniel Ellsberg, thanks for your time. Congratulations, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate you joining us. Yeah, that's our best bet. Remember yesterday we were talking about those ridiculous fans at the Blackhawks game that were chanting basketball, basketball, basketball.
Yes, yes.
At the black hockey player. So what are we going to do about that? And everybody was talking about, well, we should find these people that did it and out them. And I'm not having that debate anymore, but we did yesterday about would that actually be beneficial or not. I noted that Steve Rosenblum in the Chicago Tribune really wants the name of those people, and he really wants to out them and then, you know, let whatever mayhem befall them happen to them. That's his attitude. That's sure not mine. But somebody said on our show yesterday, well, rather than just kicking these people around, why don't we do something positive, say, on behalf of that guy, Devont Smith Pelly's charity? Could we do something that would show support for him or something that he's all about? And in the paper today, Rosenblum said that he was contacted by a guy named John Simpson, a partner with Broadhaven Capital Partners in Chicago. I guess this is a money guy. And he said the next time that the Capitals are in town, we should all wear that guy's jersey, the way you wear a Kane or a Taves or a Bobby Hull jersey. Well, let's all get a bunch of those jerseys. And he said he would donate the first 100 of them. Or make a major cash donation to that guy's charity, which is the Fort DuPont Ice Arena based in Washington, D.C. If you're so inclined, it is the Fort DuPont Ice Arena in Washington, D.C. Smith Pelly says, if you want to make a donation on my behalf there, that's how I would ask you to use your charitable dollars. Fair enough. I don't know much about that, but maybe that's where he once learned to skate, and so that's all good. But you know how much those jerseys cost? And then what are you going to do with that jersey after you have it that one time? It just seems to me like that's a really good, expensive, and not all that practical idea. Maybe just make the donation to the ice arena in the Washington, D.C. area. Fort DuPont Ice Arena would be the smartest way to go. It's 239. So we spent some time a couple of months ago talking about the gerrymandering that takes place all across the country, and Lord knows Chicago has some of the most gerrymandered districts on earth, and they benefit Democrats here, but they benefit Republicans in Pennsylvania. And in Pennsylvania, where I guess there's many more Democrats than you would ever imagine.
Well, then many more Democrats than the congressional numbers would lead you to believe.
You think that they're all Republicans there. Turns out that's not the case, and that the districting favors Republicans, but there are many more Democrats who feel like their votes aren't represented in their congressional delegation. So a judge looked at that and said, yeah, this is wrong, and you guys have to redraw them, and they have.
The Supreme Court.
And they said that as many as 4 to 6 congressional seats could go Democrat in Pennsylvania as a result.
Yeah, so it's this. You have a guy. I can't tell if you have a guest coming on. No,
I do. But finish your thought.
So it's the state Supreme Court there, who some say are controlled by the Democrats. But,
yeah, I know.
So they went to the legislature, said redraw the districts to be more fair. The governor and legislature couldn't quite agree, so the court drew their own.
Yeah.
So there's a primary coming up in May. The candidates running for Congress don't know what their districts are.
Which I think is a very manageable problem.
Sure.
Most people don't know who their congressman is anyway. I mean, that doesn't bother me. But my understanding is that now the Republicans are upset about this, understandably.
Sure.
And they may appeal it to the U.S. Supreme Court. The president has weighed in, and he said, this is the Democrats stealing the election from us.
Well, good. Then let the U.S. Supreme Court decide it. They also are considering a case out of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
That's a federal case. And is similar. There's one, I think, going on in North Carolina. It's a big, big I think it could really help change us for the better.
Sure, if more Democrats get put in office,
no,
then you're a Democrat.
No, not a Democrat. If districts are more competitive and set up fair, you know, I mean, right now, the way they're set up, Republicans are only running against Republicans in some of these and Democrats against Democrats because they're drawn in such a way that the other party could never win. So what you have are the more activist, whether they're left-wing or right-wing candidates, doing well in primaries and then not necessarily representing their constituents in office.
Micah Sims is the executive director of Common Cause Pennsylvania and joins us again on WGN. Micah, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing great. John, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Sorry to hear it's cold in Chicago, but right now it is 81 degrees in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
You're not kidding, actually, are you? It is very warm there, isn't it?
No, I'm not joking. It is actually 81 degrees today in downtown Philadelphia.
Jump into this conversation my colleague and I are having here about the way this has all played out so far. What else do you want to add to that?
Let me add into, and you guys have done a great job giving, you know, your listeners some backdrop. The new map is out. New congressional districts have been constructed. People are trying to figure out what district that they're in. I would agree with your analysis. There are potentially 4 to 6 seats that may flip, according to our analysis and the analysis of others, when you come to this primary and the general election here in Pennsylvania. I will tell you that the Republican, the GOP here in the state, in conjunction apparently with the GOP nationally, has filed, or at least I think it was supposed to happen at 3 o'clock, filed a lawsuit with the federal court asking them to stay these maps based on the time. There was not enough time is one of the things that they're crying about. There wasn't enough time to get this done.
Well, you are partisan on this yourself, though. You're rooting for the Democrats in this race, right?
I'm rooting for democracy. I think to your partner's conversation, competitive maps produce turnout. And as you indicated, there are 800,000 more Democrats in this state than there are Republicans. However, the way we live in the state, they are basically pocketed in certain areas. Yet and still, this should produce competitive races where the ideas, the thoughts, and the progressiveness that we are finding in Democratic campaigns will probably take over most of Pennsylvania, and you probably will see a nice pickup in November by the Democrats here in Pennsylvania.
How many congressional seats do you guys have?
We currently have 18. The current map was structured in such a way where 13 seats were going to the Republicans and 5 were going to the Democrats. That happened in 3 consecutive congressional races. I would say out of the 5 Democratic seats, 4 of them are safe. One is kind of moved to an open seat with the potential of getting 4 more. You could probably see a 9-9 split happen in Pennsylvania this time.
And you feel that better represents the population itself?
I think when you really look at Pennsylvania, I think it does. 800,000 vote majority is significant, but when they are basically all in the same areas, your urban areas like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and the immediate suburbs around both of those urban cities, it's a little difficult for Democrats to win seats in the middle of the state. Yes, they are making inroads, but I don't think at this point in time, you know, we'd see those particular seats begin to flip.
I'm looking for the president's tweet on this. You know the one I'm about to find, right?
Yeah, I know. It's incredible. 8:11 a.m. on yesterday, I'm getting a bunch of text messages. Guess who just weighed in? And I end up seeing the tweet from 45 indicating, you know, the Democrats are doing this.
Let me read it to you. I'll read it.
Go ahead, please.
Hope Republicans in the great state of Pennsylvania, challenge the new pushed congressional map all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary. Your original was correct. Don't let Dems take elections away from you so that they can raise taxes and waste money. You know, is it possible that while you say there are more registered Democrats in the state, that they don't vote or they don't vote enough? You know what I mean? Maybe it's possible that your state's voters really want 13 of the seats to go to Republicans.
I would probably push back against that and say no. When you look at how this map was gerrymandered, and as one of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court justices indicated, an extreme gerrymander, it was virtually impossible for Democrats to win maybe more than 6 or 7 seats. 7 is a reach. 6 is probably the high bar. It was impossible. They packed voters, Democratic voters, in Pittsburgh. They packed voters in Philadelphia and outside of the suburbs. They stretched other Democrats out in such a way where they would not be able to vote in such a way where their vote was diluted. And as we've been saying, it was basically the representatives choosing the voters, not the voters choosing the representatives.
Yeah. So then what does happen, though? I mean, so if I'm a member of Congress, I'm one of those 18 representatives, I'm still a member of Congress, but now I might represent different people. But I'm still, I presume everybody that's in office is going to run, and they'll all have challengers. So that really doesn't change the makeup of the ballot, right? It would just change who would I vote for, because now I'm no longer in the 13th, now I'm in the 12th district, and so I actually have a different representative. It's more a consequence for the voters than the politicians themselves, right?
Well, John, let me say this. Coincidentally, there were 4 Republicans who have decided to not seek re-election in Pennsylvania in 2018. Wow. I wonder why. None of them were particularly ill. None of them, you know, are going to move on to the administration or things of that nature. I will say one of them is running for the United States Senate. So I'll give one of them is doing something else in reference to politics. The rest are retiring. And then we also have one Democratic congressman that is not seeking re-election as well. But interestingly enough, you had that number happen. I wonder, did they look into a crystal ball and see that possibly fair maps were actually going to happen in 2018, and it was going to be almost impossible for them to retain their seat? There is currently a congressman right now in Pennsylvania, Ryan Costella, who has a district which is kind of in Chester County, one of the suburbs of Philadelphia, who is actually talking about that we need to impeach the Pennsylvania Supreme Court justices, because basically he's upset by the decision, and more importantly, upset by the map, that now he actually has to run a competitive race. That's the kind of political shenanigans that is going on in Pennsylvania, and the tweet from 45 just escalated it. It gave the Republicans even more energy to kind of fight this thing. We've got a new line in Pennsylvania today called Justice Mandarin. They are now declaring that it was the Supreme Court, basically because they are the majority are Democrats, basically gerrymandered the map for the Democrats. If they were going to gerry the map for the Democrats, they would have made it 13-5 for the Democrats. That map cannot, unless, you know, you end up with bad candidates, produce a 13-5 split all of a sudden for the Democrats. That's not what these justices did. And I have a problem when you have elected officials really attacking the character of Supreme Court justices. That's not what they did. Actually, John, this should have not even gotten to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. The legislature should have brought a map forward that made sense,
right,
so that the governor would have signed it, and this would have never gotten to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court simply stepped in because there was a failure at the legislative branch.
Okay, so what is it, March primary and May election? Is that the way it works?
We've got petitions start here in Pennsylvania February 27th for the congressional candidates. We have a May 15th primary, assuming that there are no stays from the United States Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And then, none of us believe that.
And then the election in November.
I don't see that happening. And then the general election in November.
Yeah, May and November. Okay, yeah. All right, Micah. Well, good luck to you guys over there. Fascinating stuff. And it's not just Pennsylvania that's dealing with this, but we've been following that issue through your lens. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me on, John.
Micah Sims is the executive director of Common Cause Pennsylvania. Looking at the list of presidents, I guess every 4 years they do this. A ranking of the presidents. So once again, Lincoln is number one. He was 4 years ago as well.
That's our guy.
He's our boy.
Honest Abe.
Keeping it real for Illinois. Who's number two? George Washington.
Of course.
Now
he's the best. Second best.
Second best. Number three is?
JFK.
JFK is up there. He is number 16.
Oh.
You're thinking Teddy Roosevelt is 3, and I love me some TR. Then Thomas Jefferson is 4. Truman is 5. Eisenhower. Obama has gone from number 18 in 2014 to now number 8. Ronald Reagan went from number 11 to number 9. And LBJ is number 10, and that's your top 10. President Trump right now is in last place, followed by going up Buchanan, Harrison, Pierce, and Johnson.
But I wonder if the current president is ever high on that list.
The article I read today said, listen, take these things with a grain of salt. Number one, these are academics who probably don't like Trump to begin with. A lot of them are Democrats. And number two, it is almost impossible to get a sense of where any given president is during their term. You need some time and distance. I don't know how Trump's going to do in the long run, but based on that, I'm not surprised to see him where he is.